ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Tuesday, the 4th of August. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. It's now almost certain the federal government will be forced to take tougher action against gambling companies after explosive evidence in a Senate inquiry yesterday revealed drugs, escorts and bonus bets were allegedly being used to keep problem gamblers punting. Political opponents to Labor's left and right want stronger restrictions than what the government has proposed. Oliver Gordon reports.
VIP managers wanted to make former NRL player Luke Bateman feel special, so he would bet more money.
There were times where I would be flown interstate and taken to, you know, race days, put in marquees with alcohol and food provided all day, things like that.
The reformed problem gambler airing these allegations against an unnamed betting company at a Senate inquiry into the government's proposed gambling laws.
Before getting there, your VIP manager would offer you, go, hey, mate, what drugs do you want? Do you want a couple of bags for this weekend? We'll organise that for you. We'll have that ready for you when you get here.
He's also told the inquiry that at the peak of his addiction, he did drugs with the company's executives at their events.
And at that stage, I would have been 23-year-old.
Mark Kempster is one of the public faces of the Alliance for Gambling Reform and says Luke Bateman's experience isn't unique.
Yeah, over the last 2 to 3 years, there'd be at least a dozen that I know of that have come to me in that way.
Labor's proposed laws would see a partial ban on betting ads, sports stars banned from promoting betting companies, and stadiums and jerseys made gambling ad-free. But they do not include a full ban on gambling inducements or a total ban on online gambling ads, despite these being recommendations of late Labor MP Peter Murphy's landmark 2013 report into gambling harms. Mark Kempster again.
I think it's a line in the sand for the government. If they don't stand up and do something after hearing the evidence this morning, I generally do not know what the role of that government is at the moment.
To pass, Labor's gambling laws need the support of either the Greens or the Coalition in the Senate. The Greens are appealing to the Coalition to team up with them to overhaul the laws. Liberal frontbencher Simon Kennedy.
What I can tell you, listeners, is we will be strengthening these laws and I will be fighting for that. I don't care who that's working with. I'm not worried about political alliances. What I'm worried about is protecting vulnerable Australians and children from predatory gambling advertising. And if that's the object, we'll work with anyone, but the Coalition will stand up for families because that's what we believe in.
Simon Kennedy says it's his personal view regulations on inducements should be strengthened.
We heard today in the inquiry of gambling companies using predatory inducements. Even cocaine and prostitutes were mentioned. We have to clean up inducements that get people betting above their head and way beyond it.
What does cleaning up inducements look like, Simon Kennedy?
I think there should be a duty of care. And we should be exploring concepts like a duty of care on gambling agencies to stop gambling harm.
Independent Senator David Pocock says he'll be working to find a way to force the government into a complete ban on inducements.
This is a huge opportunity for the Coalition. We need to see action in this bill on banning inducements.
Senator Pocock, who's on the Senate committee examining the government's legislation, is also pushing for a total gambling ad ban.
And clearly, every witness just makes the case for a national regulator. The regulations are so loose, and this is a multi-billion dollar industry that is effectively unregulated because we leave it up to the NT government to regulate.
In a statement, a government spokesperson has said it's focused on strengthening the National Register Bet Stop that allows people who don't want to place a bet or get inducements to opt out. Wagering company Sportsbet says there's no evidence it's involved with allegations heard at the inquiry, and Tabcorp says that allegations around inducements made at the inquiry are not part of its customer offering. The peak body for wagering companies was also contacted for comment. The inquiry continues today, and we'll hear from representatives of the wagering companies.
And that report from Oliver Gordon and Adam Langenberg. And if you or someone you know needs help, you can call the National Gambling Helpline on 1800 858 858. Experts say the deadly H5 bird flu outbreak is taking hold in Australia after a mass mortality of native birds on South Australia's southeast coast. There are now 78 confirmed cases in Australia, but there's no evidence of bird flu in poultry or the agricultural sector yet. Stephanie Smale reports.
South Australia is currently the epicentre of the deadly H5 bird flu outbreak, but the risk is nationwide. The federal government says it was bracing for a mass mortality like the greater crested terns at Cape Jaffa, and there could be more. Professor Kirsty Short is a virologist at the University of Queensland.
It's not established in Australia, but there are starting to be signs that it is. So it's certainly elevated all the responses to the next stage.
What are the risks now?
We have two major groups of risks. The first risk is to our poultry population, that this could get into a poultry farm, and where we know that H5N1 causes widespread death and devastation, essentially. And then the other major risk is to our native species and causing potentially mass mortality of native species, not just avian species, but also potentially marine mammals, scavenger species, because we know that that's happened overseas.
And as you see it, are the right management approaches being taken?
Overall, I think we're doing really, really well. It's a difficult situation. It's not like COVID where you can close the borders and people listen, birds don't listen. And so it is a really, really challenging thing to get hold of.
She says vaccines are an option going forward.
Vaccination of poultry is certainly possible. That's what France did. They vaccinated their duck population and that really brought their outbreaks under control. But that came with a significant cost, and it meant that the US would no longer import poultry products from France. And so the concern is if we vaccinate our poultry population, it will have significant trade implications. And then vaccination of native species is something quite interesting. At the moment, the decision is based purely on endangered species. But one of the things we're arguing with our research is that it should be a bit more nuanced than that. And we should look at specific susceptibility to avian influenza.
University of Queensland virologist Professor Kirsty Short, ending that report by Stephanie Smale. The Queensland government is considering a request that could see more police pursuits in the state. The officers' union wants restrictions on chasing fleeing criminals eased, but civil rights groups warn it could see more innocent bystanders put in harm's way. Annie Guest reports.
When police pursue criminals on Queensland's roads, their union boss Shane Pryor believes they're hampered by rules restricting pursuits to situations involving a serious crime or threat to life.
I think it's very fair to say that the current pursuit policy hasn't stopped offenders from engaging in dangerous behaviour on the road.
So the Queensland government is considering a union request to expand police pursuit powers, with the Premier David Crisafulli reportedly telling a police union conference that officers should not have to second guess whether or not they're able to do their jobs. Terry O'Gorman is the president of the Queensland Council for Civil Liberties.
In the 10-year period from 2000 to 2009 in Queensland, there were 22 deaths arising from police chases and 690 people injured. It was because of that appalling rate of harm to innocent members of the public that the current police pursuit policy was implemented.
That was 20 years ago, and the deaths included a 13-year-old girl hit outside her school by a stolen vehicle evading a high-speed police chase. Her case was then used as an example in police training. Union boss Shane Pryor again.
Our police make wise decisions and ethical decisions absolutely every single day in Queensland. And I have every faith that if a pursuit was getting that ridiculously dangerous, then the appropriate decisions would be made and other avenues would be canvassed.
The Crime and Corruption Commission has previously found strict pursuit policies and legislated alternatives significantly reduced injuries and deaths. Terry O'Gorman says any proposed change should face an external review.
The Premier should not just give in to the union's wish list and say, OK, we'll give you greater powers to chase people in cars.
Why do you think the Premier is going down this track?
It's simply the Premier beating the law and order drum and being on side with the police.
But Voice for Victims Chairman Ben Cannon supports the push.
I certainly know from speaking to a number of police that some of these pursuits that are called off or they are kind of pulled away from, these criminals go on and commit a raft of crimes and commit a whole lot more harm to the community that could have possibly been prevented if they had been able to engage a pursuit and stop them.
Police union boss Shane Pryor says their members also want the power to collect DNA samples from children who haven't been charged.
It's very simple. If a young offender is old enough to become a serial offender, then they're old enough to have their DNA recorded. Now, we're not asking extremes here. We're asking for the disparity between adult and youth offenders on DNA collection to be removed.
It raises concerns about potential human rights violations, and Terry O'Gorman believes collecting DNA once a child is charged is sufficient.
And we say that the police union have not demonstrated that the system is not working.
But victims advocate Ben Cannon says the community would be kept safer by expanded police powers.
We're certainly supporting anything that they would see as a way that they could catch more criminals and allow them to do their job.
Voice for Victims Chairman Ben Cannon ending Annie Guest's report. There's a serious push to remove FIFA boss Gianni Infantino after his failed bid to sell off stakes in the World Cup. England has joined several other countries preparing to withdraw their support for his re-election bid. US media is reporting Mr. Infantino tried to enlist the support of the White House to keep his job. Professor James Reid is an expert on sporting governance based at the University of Reading in the UK. He spoke to me earlier. Professor Reid, thanks for joining me on AM this morning.
Good morning.
Can Gianni Infantino withstand the pressure that he's facing at the moment, or are we seeing the beginning of the end of his leadership?
Well, he's always had a lot of support, right, from African nations, from the Asian nations, and generally not the UEFA nations, which obviously are leading the charge at the moment. So he's probably still got quite a bit of support. So it's possible he manages to find ways. And of course, Donald Trump, has him on speed dial. So maybe he's got something up his sleeve yet.
The trigger for the rebellion has been his plan to sell off stakes in the World Cup. Why was he pursuing that?
Well, there's all sorts of theories, isn't there? And it's been revealed that he had his eye on eventually running this spin-off organisation that would run the competition. At the end of the day, the governors of the big major league competitions in the US earn multiples of what he earns heading up the global sport. And so you can imagine that that was potentially behind what he was proposing to do. But it's worth also saying that it's just the culmination of the way that FIFA's expanded the game over the years. And, there's something virtuous about that. The football is now, a soccer is the global sport, and that's in no small way down to how FIFA has expanded the game since the 1970s, expanding the World Cup from a very cozy club of nations in South America and Europe, whereas now it truly is a global game, and it's been done through keeping lots of nations on side all around the world. So this is, in many respects, just the culmination of that process over the last 50 years or so.
Yeah, in some ways there's been an enormous success in the sport itself, in its global reach, but at the same time we see so many controversies in its governance, and that goes back beyond Gianni Infantino's tenure, including his predecessors. Why is keeping governance in line so difficult for a global sporting body like FIFA?
Well, ultimately, who regulates the regulator? Who is there to tell Gianni Infantino what to do or set Blatter before him? They have a level of power that no one can really challenge them on. And so I think that's possibly, at the root of what ultimately happens is that power corrupts. Now, there's been lots of good been done, undoubtedly. Lots and lots of money gone to grassroots organisations playing soccer around the world. And that's a wonderful thing. At the same time, though, of course, lots of these sums of money going to football associations around the world almost certainly go to bad actors in these places. And a more transparent decision-making process at the top would surely lead to a better allocation of the huge revenues that FIFA is able to command each World Cup cycle.
So if we look at the position FIFA finds itself in now, how does this get resolved?
It kind of feels like it's on a knife edge with UEFA pushing what it's pushed, and with the Welsh Football Association and the English saying that they'll withdraw their support. It feels like that's a strong power base. But as said, often the Europeans aren't necessarily that well received around the world, by the smaller football associations. We're the old guard, and we're protecting what we've had in the past. And so not necessarily the case that just because here in Europe, UEFA is leading the charge, it isn't necessarily the case that the rest of the world will necessarily follow. It's a seductive thing if Infantino says to your football association, your Cape Verde or your someone else, who doesn't command the kinds of revenues that the Football Association in England can command, being able to be given £20 million, that's a very seductive proposition. So it may well be yet that his power base is stronger than we think, and it may well be that he does survive. It'll be fascinating to see.
I'm really looking forward to the next few chapters in this story. Professor, thanks very much for joining me on AM today.
Thank you.
And Professor Reid is an expert on sporting governance from the University of Reading. Behind the neon lights of Japan's bustling capital, geisha are still practicing their traditional arts, but the numbers have fallen sharply in recent years, and it's prompted one of the country's oldest and most famous geisha to speak out and press for change in how things are done in what's usually a closed world. North Asia correspondent Natalie Whiting reports from Tokyo.
86-year-old Ikuko sits in front of a tatami mat, watching geisha she's trained flourish fans and move in perfect unison in a dance rehearsal. I should be up there practicing, she laments, but my feet are a bit sore. Meanwhile, if I don't keep at it, I won't be able to dance when the time comes. She follows along, her hands mimicking the moves. Ikuko has been a geisha for more than 60 years. She was the first to be awarded Japan's prestigious Order of the Rising Sun. But she's worried about the next generation. In 1940, there were about 13,000 geisha in Tokyo. Now, there are about 200. I feel that the reward I've been given, she says, and the legacy I must leave, is to protect this world of geisha. She and the members of her geisha house will soon be taking part in an outdoor festival to try to promote the tradition. Geisha usually perform at high-end banquets for exclusive clients, where they dance, play instruments, and ensure conversation flows. There are still young women prepared to take on this life of dedication, including 22-year-old Saku, who's an apprentice. Geisha continue training throughout their lives, she says. As it's a profession with no retirement age, I'll be practicing for as long as I carry on doing this. But geisha need customers. And over the years, many of the exclusive venues they work in have closed. So this tea house has thrown out the rule book. They now allow anyone to book, including tourists, and they advertise on social media. I feel that if we just cling to the old ways, things will inevitably go downhill, the owner, Okami Chikage, tells me. I really do believe that unless we preserve what's good and embrace the new, things won't work out. But will it be enough? At her outdoor festival, Ikuko takes to the stage and dances with aplomb, despite her recent injury. She's hoping to get funding from the Tokyo government to put on a much bigger performance with all of Tokyo's geisha. I want to increase our fan base even more, she says, to ensure this modern city's past is part of its future. This is Natalie Whiting in Tokyo, reporting for AM.
And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The cut to the fuel excise has ended, but the Iran war hasn't. So what does that mean for how much we'll be paying at the fuel pump in the months ahead? Today, Sol Kavanagh, energy expert at MST Financial, on the world's diminishing fuel supply. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on ABC Listen.